and then uncross them, you will likely do the exact same thing without even realizing it. It's not some kind of Jedi mind trick. It's called pacing and leading. It's the next level up from matching, which is what I spoke about before when we were talking about handshakes. With pacing and leading, you're basically kicking it up a notch by pacing them, and then leading them in the direction that you want them to go. When it's done right, it's an immensely powerful strategy, and it works with both tonality and body language. Active listening and the art of matching. Before we dive more deeply into pacing and leading, let's discuss another important concept, active listening. This is a way of listening to someone that helps you actually build rapport with them. One of the greatest misconceptions about tonality and body language is that they only come into play while you're the one doing the talking. In fact, how you move your body, the facial expressions you make, how you smile, and all those little grunts and groans you make as someone's talking to you, those are all part of the technique I call active listening, and it's a powerful way to get into rapport with someone. Let's start with something as simple as nodding your head while your prospect is speaking. When you nod your head, it shows that you get what the person is saying, that you're on the same page. The same thing goes for facial expressions, like when your prospect starts talking about something that's very important to them. You want to look straight into their eyes, with your own eyes narrowed a bit, and with your mouth crooked to one side. Then you add an occasional nod, along with a few ahas, and yups, and I got it. Now, if that was my body language while you were explaining your problems to me, what would you think about me? Would you think that I was really listening to you? That I truly cared? Yes. There are other facial expressions, too, like compressing your lips and lowering your head a bit, which implies sadness, or compressing your lips and nodding your head slowly, which implies sympathy and empathy. The master of this type of body language is President Bill Clinton. Back in his prime, he was the absolute best. He'd shake at least 100 hands a day, and he only had a split second to earn someone's trust, and he could do it every time. It seemed that from the second when he shook your hand and you fell into his magnetic zone, you got the feeling that he truly cared about you, that he felt your pain. As for the audible cues, the ahas and yups, they're more effective at maintaining rapport than actually building it. They let the prospect know that you're still on the same page with them, that you get what they're saying. The audible cues are even more important when you're on the phone and don't have body language to rely on. In that case, those little grunts and groans are the only way to stay in rapport with your prospect while they're talking. When you're in person, though, you can also use matching, essentially adopting the same physiology as your prospect to slide into rapport with them. Some examples of this are the position of their body, their posture, and also their breathing rate. Even how fast they blink can be matched. Matching is an incredibly powerful tool for getting into rapport with someone, especially when you're in person and you can match both body language and tonality. But it can also be extremely effective over the phone if you focus on matching not just someone's tonality, but also their rate of speech and the type of words they use, including any slang. And before you think I'm saying something creepy about copying someone, let's review again. You're not copying, you're matching them. There's a big difference. Copying someone is called mirroring, meaning that you actually try to mirror your prospect's physical actions in real time as they're doing them. If they scratch their nose, then you scratch your nose. And if they cross their legs and lean back in their seat, then you cross your legs and lean back in your seat. Now that is creepy, and it's also obvious, which is something I'm not a fan of at all. But I am a fan of matching, which means that if your prospect leans back in their seat, then you lean back in your seat too, but you do it slowly, casually, after a 5 or 10 second lag. In the end, it all goes back to likability, meaning that people want to do business with people who are basically like them, not different. You start that process by entering a prospect's world where they are, which sets you up to slide into rapport. Then you want to pace them, and then lead them in the direction that you want them to go. This is a really powerful tool when you use it right. Remember, there's pace-pace-lead, and there's pace-pace-fucking-lead. That's the way I teach it, ninja style, on steroids. What I mean by this is that they don't see it coming. Don't forget that pacing is one of those things in life that needs to be done exactly right, or else it won't work. When you actually do get it right, then watch out. Not only will it help you get into super tight rapport with someone, it will also help you change his or her emotional state from a negative one to a positive one and increase the level of certainty. One story I like to tell about this is the time my son Carter came home from soccer practice absolutely furious about this kid on his team who was a major ball hog. That night, my fiance said, "Carter is really, really upset. Why don't you go downstairs and see if you can calm him down?" Here's what I didn't do. I didn't walk downstairs acting all soft and sympathetic like I was trying to calm him down. I didn't drop my tone and say, "Listen, buddy, I know you're really upset right now, but you shouldn't let someone get to you like that. It's not good for you." Why? Because then he would have gotten even madder. He'd have been like, "Don't get upset. What do you mean, don't get upset? The kid's a damn ball hog. I hate him. Everyone hates him. He should be thrown off the team." And then I'd say, whoa, calm down, buddy. It's no big deal. Relax for a second. At which point he'd get even madder. He'd be like, "Bullshit, it is a big deal. I'm not going to calm down." By trying to enter his world in a calm state when he is in an aggravated one, I'd only have aggravated him even more. So instead, I matched him. I walked in acting as pissed off and as angry as he was. In fact, I acted even angrier. I said with my voice booming, "What the hell is going on, Carter? I know that bastard of a kid is a ball hog. We've got to do something about it right now. Should we call the coach and get him thrown off the team?" Then he matched me, just like I knew he would. He became just as angry as he thought I was. And he said, "Yeah, let's call the coach. Let's get him thrown off the team. That kid's a menace." To which I said, "Yeah, let's do that, buddy." And just like that, I began lowering my voice and taking on a more sympathetic tone. Then I shook my head sadly and said, "I don't know, buddy. I wonder what causes him to act that way. You think he has some emotional problems?" And then I softened my voice even more and added, "It really is a shame." And of course, Carter started shaking his head sadly too. He said in a tone as sympathetic as mine, "Yeah, it really is, Dad. I guess I should feel bad for him. He's probably really unhappy." And just like that, he calmed down. Matching can be a way to calm anyone down, or get them excited about something, or feeling certain about something. You simply enter their world where they are, and then you pace them, and then you lead them in the direction you want them to go. Now, I didn't invent pacing and leading. It's been around since the very dawn of human communication. All great communicators do this. They do it naturally, without even thinking about it. But anyone can learn it, once they know the rules. Remember, the next step in the system, which is the simultaneous gathering of intelligence and building rapport, is more about what your prospect will say to you than what you'll say to your prospect. In fact, the best way to explain this to you is to go through a simple yet very powerful exercise. The time has now come for me to sell you a pen. Nine, the art of prospecting. Sell me this pen. The first time I sprung this on a cocky young salesman, I was sitting behind my desk in my office at Stratton, and what I got in return was a very telling response. "You see this pen?" chirped the cocky young recruit, sounding like he just walked off a used car lot. "This is the most amazing pen money can buy. You can write upside down. You'll never run out of ink. Feels great in your hand. Here, check it out for yourself. Tell me how great it feels." And with that, he leaned forward in his seat and extended his arm across my desktop and offered me the same disposable pen that I'd handed to him a moment earlier to begin the test. Playing along, I grabbed the pen and rolled it around on my fingers for a few seconds until it slid into its usual writing position. "Pretty damn amazing, right?" he pressed. "It feels like a pen," I replied flatly. "That's exactly my point," he explained, ignoring my lukewarm response. "That's how a great pen is supposed to feel, like it's been a part of you for years. Anyway, it's obvious that you and this pen were made for each other, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take 30% off the regular purchase price, but," he raised his index finger in the air for a moment, "only if you buy it right now. Otherwise, it has to go back to the normal price. Either way, it's a really great deal, but at 30% off, it's the deal of the century. What do you say?" "What do I say?" I shot back. "You mean besides the fact that you're obviously completely full of shit?" No response. The would-be Stratonite just sat there completely still with a panic-stricken look on his face. "That wasn't a rhetorical question. You want me to ignore how completely full of shit you are, yes or no?" He slowly opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. He just sat there with his mouth hanging open. "I'll take that as a yes," I continued, deciding to let the kid off the hook. "So putting that small detail aside for the time being, I will say that I'm not in the market for a pen right now. I don't want one, I don't need one, I barely ever use one, and in truth, if I ever do decide to go out and buy a pen, it won't be a piece of shit like this. I'd probably pick up a Mont Blanc or something." "But how could you possibly know that?" I continued, zeroing in on the main point of the exercise. "In fact, how could you know anything about me? From the second you opened up your mouth, all you did was spew out a bunch of cheap sales talk. 'The pen is this,' I chirped, mocking his used car salesman rap. 'The pen is that. The pen writes upside down. It's your long-lost brother,' and blah, blah, fucking blah. Even if you put aside how utterly ridiculous that sounds, did it ever occur to you to ask me a few questions before you attempted to ram a pen down my throat? Like, am I even in the market for a pen? Do I have a certain price range in mind? Do I prefer one type of pen to another? I mean, think about it for a second. How can you try to sell me something without knowing the first thing about me? It completely defies logic." The would-be Stratonite nodded his head sheepishly. "So what should I have said? You tell me," I shot back. Just then the door swung open, and Danny walked into the office wearing a $2,000 suit and a cynical expression. "You almost done with this?" he asked. "Almost," I replied, "but I'm actually glad you popped in. Your timing's perfect. I need you to do something for me." "What's that?" he answered cautiously. "I want you to sell me this pen," I declared, grabbing another pen off my desktop and extending my hand towards him. Danny shot me a look. "You want me to sell you a pen? Seriously? Fine, I'll sell it to you," he muttered, grabbing the pen and taking a moment to examine it. Then, all at once, he completely changed his demeanor and flashed me a warm smile and said in a respectful tone, "So tell me, Jordan, how long have you been in the market for a pen?" "I'm not in the market," I replied. "I don't use pens." "Really? Well, then you can have your lousy pen back," he snapped, tossing the pen back onto my desktop. Then he looked at the kid and said, "I don't sell things to people who don't need them. I'll leave that to novices like you." While the moral of the story seems plainly obvious, there's actually a lot more going on here than meets the eye. So let me take things one at a time, starting with the obvious. Firstly, it should be crystal clear to you by now that trying to sell something to someone who doesn't need it or want it is a fool's errand and a total waste of time. A straight-line salesperson, and for that matter, any professional salesperson, would never consider shooting from the hip like that. Instead, they would sift through their prospects as quickly and efficiently as possible, separating out the ones who were interested from the ones who weren't. In general sales parlance, this sifting process is referred to as qualifying a prospect, and the primary method by which a prospect gets qualified is by answering a series of questions that get posed to the prospect by the salesperson. All in all, it's a cut-and-dried, no-frills process that's utilitarian in nature and gets straight to the point. If, upon answering your questions, it turns out that the prospect needs what you're selling and can afford to pay for it, then they're qualified. It's as simple as that. And then you have the straight line system, where the word qualifying is never to be uttered under penalty of, well, not death, but at least shame. Here, we refer to this process as straight line prospecting, and the primary method by which we do our sifting is through gathering intelligence. Now, if you recall, I touched on this topic at the end of chapter 2, when I presented you with the flashback from the night when I first invented the straight line system. When you gather intelligence, I explained, you want to know everything there is to know about your prospect, so long as it's relevant to closing the sale, including their needs, beliefs, values, hierarchy of values, meaning the relative importance of each value, their past experiences with similar products, past experiences with other salespeople, personal financial situation, insofar as affording your product, and both their primary and their secondary pain points. On top of that, what I also explained that night, and what I want to re-emphasize now and dig into more deeply, was the fact that your ability to gather intelligence will be directly related to how powerful a first impression you made on your prospect during those first 4 seconds. In other words, the only way that your prospects will answer your questions honestly and forthrightly is if they perceive you as being a true expert in your field and a person whose confidence and eloquence and bottled enthusiasm has left them with no doubt whatsoever that you're definitely a person worth listening to, someone who can help them achieve their goals and resolve their pain. Without that, there's simply no reason for your prospects to waste their time opening up to you or risk the embarrassment or loss of confidentiality that could result from it. So instead, they'll only give you perfunctory answers to your questions, or more likely, they'll try to take control of the sale themselves, causing things to spiral out of control. I've seen it happen 1,000 times. A novice salesperson tries to qualify a prospect, only to have the prospect answer their questions with questions of their own, until the whole thing has devolved into chaos. It's a perfect example of the Iron Mike Tyson metaphor I used at the end of chapter 2. The only difference is that instead of getting barraged by devastating punches, you're getting barraged with devastating questions. Devastating in the sense that they'll cause you to veer off the straight line and go spiraling off to Pluto or, even worse, your anus. Conversely, when you are in control, the barraging stops. Realizing that they are in the presence of an expert in their respective field, the prospect feels compelled to defer to you and allows you to ask as many questions as you deem necessary without interruption. Now, this latter point is absolutely crucial because in the absence of interruptions, questions can now be asked in a manner and sequence that not only promotes a smooth, mutually productive intelligence gathering session, but also enhances your ability to build rapport. But I'm jumping ahead now. Straight line prospecting has more moving parts than any other step in the syntax, so the most effective way to teach it to you is to start with the big picture first. Let me zoom out for a moment and give you a quick overview of the relationship between marketing and sales, insofar as how they work hand in hand with one another to turn a company's goods and services into cash, and how straight-line prospecting serves as the bridge between the two. In essence, you have marketing on one side of the equation and sales on the other. The objective of marketing is to, 1, research the marketplace to identify the best prospective buyers, prospects for short, for a particular product. 2, develop a cost-effective strategy that gets the company's message in front of as many of these prospects as possible. 3, embed the message with some sort of offer or hook or call to action that prompts as many of these prospects as possible to enter the company's sales funnel. And 4, coordinate with the sales department to ensure a seamless handoff of the funnel so prospects can be turned into customers. Now, in today's world, there are 2 types of marketing. First, we have offline marketing, which includes everything that takes place off the internet, TV and radio ads, newspaper ads, magazine ads, billboard ads, direct mail, telemarketing, network marketing, educational marketing, door-knocking campaigns, etc. And second, we have online marketing, which includes everything that takes place on the internet. Google ads, Facebook ads, Twitter ads, YouTube ads, banner ads, landing pages, opt-ins, retargeting campaigns, email blasts, affiliate marketing, SEO campaigns, and much, much more. Now, as I said, Whichever marketing modality a company decides to use, the ultimate objective is always the same. To bring as many qualified buyers as possible into the company's sales funnel so they can then be handed off to the sales department and turned into customers. Pretty straightforward, right? Actually, not quite. You see, no matter how carefully you target your marketing campaign, there is no possible way that every prospect who enters your sales funnel will end up being a qualified buyer. In fact, in most cases, if even half of those prospects turn out to be qualified buyers, then you're doing great. In essence, this is what straight-line prospecting is all about. Sifting through prospects who enter your sales funnel to eliminate the ones who don't qualify to buy your product, thereby avoiding wasting your time making a full-blown sales presentation to them. To that end, in any given marketing campaign, there are four categories of buyers who will enter your sales funnel. We call these the four buying archetypes. The first archetype is called buyers in heat. These are basically your best, most motivated buyers. These prospects want your product, need your product, can benefit from your product, can afford your product, and most importantly, they're prepared to make a buying decision right now. Like all legitimate buyers, buyers in heat have a certain pain they're looking to resolve. However, what separates them from the rest of the pack is that they've already made the decision to do something about it now. In other words, they're done waiting. They're ready to act. They've gotten to the point where they are simply no longer willing to tolerate the pain that comes from an unresolved need. So they've decided to get proactive. The only downside to this group of ready-made buyers is that there aren't that many of them. Depending on what industry you're in and how targeted your marketing campaign was, you'll find that somewhere between 10 and 20% of the total prospects that enter your sales funnel will fall into this category. The rest will be spread among the other three. The second buying archetype is called buyers in power. These are your second best group of buyers. The primary difference between these first two archetypes is that buyers in power aren't consciously feeling any major pain from their unfulfilled need, which causes them to lack the same level of urgency as buyers in heat. In other words, while buyers in power have every intention of buying the type of product you're selling, their lack of urgency makes them feel like they're in a position of power. So they're not going to pull the trigger until they're done shopping around and have made themselves absolutely certain that they found the best solution to their problem. Nonetheless, these are still excellent prospects, and there are also a heck of a lot more of them than buyers in heat. On average, somewhere between 30 and 40% of the total prospects that enter your sales funnel will end up falling into this category. At the end of the day, it's the prospects from these two categories, buyers in heat and buyers in power, who will make it past the intelligence gathering phase and continue their journey down the straight line. The prospects from the remaining two buying archetypes need to be weeded out as quickly as possible, especially those who fall into the third archetype, the dreaded looky-loos. Also known as tire kickers, the looky-loos are the most dangerous prospects that will enter your sales funnel. What makes them so destructive is that they disguise themselves as buyers in power, acting as if they're genuinely interested in buying your product, while they actually have no intention of doing so. In consequence, they continue their journey down the straight line as opposed to getting weeded out during the intelligence gathering phase, as they're supposed to be. The resulting damage occurs on two levels. First, and most obviously, it causes a massive amount of time to be wasted as you end up making full-blown sales presentations to prospects who have no intention of buying. And second, and even more damaging, is the confusion and negativity it creates as a novice salesperson tries to figure out why their closing rate is so low. Is there something wrong with me, the salesperson wonders? Is it their pitch? Is the salesperson not making a strong enough logical case? Emotional case? Or maybe the salesperson is screwing up at the other end during the objection handling phase. After all, the prospects remain interested the whole way through, giving the salesperson buy signal after buy signal to the very end. And then they don't buy. You see the problem here? Having no idea that between 30 and 40% of their sales funnel is filled with professional time wasters disguised as buyers in power, salespeople end up spending the bulk of their time making sales presentations to prospects who have no intention of buying. The good news is that identifying them isn't very difficult. There are four telltale signs that will alert you to the fact that you're having your time wasted by a looky-loo. One, they tend to ask lots of questions that they seem to already know the answers to. Two, they make it a point to kick the tires of whatever it is you're selling, almost to the point of overkicking them. Three, they let out a large number of oohs and ahs and yups to reinforce the sense that they're genuinely interested. And four, when asked about their finances, they either become boisterously overconfident or unnecessarily vague. Again, I can't overestimate the importance of being hypervigilant when it comes to identifying and weeding out the looky-loos as quickly as possible. You'll end up avoiding a lot of pain over the long run. Now, this takes us to the fourth and final buying archetype, which I refer to as the mistakes, or the people who were dragged there. In essence, these are people who never belonged in your sales funnel in the first place. Either they clicked on the wrong website, showed up at your place of business by mistake, or they were simply dragged into your sales funnel by someone else. Whatever the case, the common thread among all the mistakes is that they had no desire to enter your sales funnel in the first place, so you have basically no chance of closing them. So in summary, the three main goals of straight-line prospecting are as follows. One, identify the looky-loos and the mistakes and remove them from your sales funnel as quickly as possible. Two, gather the necessary intelligence from the buyers in heat and the buyers in power, and then continue moving them down the straight line towards the close. And three, begin the process of turning the buyers in power into buyers in heat by amplifying their pain. Now, insofar as number three is concerned, there's a lot more to this concept than it makes sense to discuss now. So let me circle back to it when we get to the next chapter, which covers the 10 core distinctions of straight-line prospecting. In fact, let's dive into that chapter right now. It's time to take you from the theory of straight-line prospecting to the real-world application of it. The next chapter will show you precisely how to get there. The 10 rules of straight-line prospecting. When you're properly engaging in the process of straight-line prospecting, you're doing each of the following four things. One, you're sifting through the prospects in your sales funnel by asking them a series of strategically prepared questions. Two, you're using these questions to not only gather intelligence, but also to separate buyers in heat and buyers in power from the looky-loos and the mistakes. Three, you're continuing to gather intelligence from the buyers in heat and buyers in power while eliminating the looky-loos and mistakes from your sales funnel as quickly as possible. And four, you're transitioning the buyers in heat and the buyers in power to the next step in the syntax so they can continue their journey down the straight line. Insofar as the 10 rules of prospecting are concerned, they are meant to provide you with everything you'll need to create a practical blueprint for gathering intelligence in your industry. Now, as you go through each rule, you should keep relating it back to your own situation, making whatever changes are needed to your current method of prospecting. To that end, if you have a prospecting script or a list of intelligence gathering questions, then you should have those in front of you before we begin. So grab those now and let's get started. Rule number one, you are a sifter, not an alchemist. Imagine yourself as one of those old-fashioned gold prospectors who kneels at the edge of a stream with your trusty tin pan, sifting through thousands of gallons of water as you patiently wait for that one nugget of gold to drop into your pan. It's a sight that we've all seen countless times, both in the movies and on TV. An old miner with his scraggly beard, playing the waiting game by the edge of a stream. He'll wait there as long as he has to, knowing full well that sooner or later, a nugget of gold will present itself. However, what he's not waiting for is for the water itself to turn into gold. That's a job for an alchemist, not a prospector. You see my point? Water is water, and gold is gold. They're different elements that don't magically convert into one another any more than looky-loos and mistakes convert into buyers in heat or buyers in power. That's why a salesperson has to become an expert sifter, not an alchemist. There's simply no two ways about it. Rule number two. Always ask for permission to ask questions. As easy as this distinction is to execute, virtually all untrained salespeople ignore it, simply because they're unaware of how negatively it will impact their ability to get into rapport. Plain and simple, unless you ask for permission to ask questions, you run an extremely high risk of being perceived as the Grand Inquisitor type instead of a trusted advisor. And the Grand Inquisitor type doesn't care about you, nor they just like you, which are the two driving forces behind getting into rapport. However, the good news here is that all you have to do to avoid this outcome is remember always to ask for permission to ask questions. It's as simple as that. Below are a few sample language patterns that get straight to the point and have been proven to work. 1. John, just a couple of quick questions so I don't waste your time. 2. John, let me ask you a couple of quick questions so I can best serve you. And 3. John, let me ask you just a couple of quick questions so I can see exactly what your needs are. Any one of the above examples will set you up for a non-confrontational intelligence gathering session that promotes the building of rapport. In addition, I want you to notice how I use the word so in the second half of each of the three examples. In this context, we refer to the word so as a justifier because it justifies your need to ask the prospect questions as opposed to doing it out of curiosity or nosiness. In essence, in order to do your job correctly, there are certain things that you need to know in your capacity as an expert. By using a justifier, you can get that point across to your prospect loud and clear, and it paves the way for an even more productive intelligence gathering session. Rule number 3. You must always use a script. I'm only going to touch on this rule briefly, as the entire next chapter is dedicated to the creation of scripts and how they roll up into one cohesive presentation. One of the key reasons why you want to always use a script for prospecting is that each industry has its own unique set of questions that need to be asked in a certain order. If you try to wing it, as opposed to having all your questions mapped out in advance in precisely the right order, then the chances of you remembering all the questions or asking them all in the right order is slim to none. And each mistake you make will have a negative impact on your ability to gather intelligence. Another major benefit of using a prospecting script is that since you already know what words you're going to say, your conscious mind is freed up to focus on applying the right tonality to your words, as well as on what your prospect is communicating back to you. Are there any clues in their facial expression, or their tone of voice, or their general body language? Again, I'm going to be digging into this in much greater detail in the following chapter, so let's move on. Rule number 4. Go from less invasive questions to more invasive questions. By asking non-invasive questions first, you give yourself the opportunity to start building rapport by actively listening to your prospect's answers. It's almost like peeling back the layers of an onion. Each non-invasive question that your prospect answers creates an even tighter state of rapport, which paves the way for you to ask successfully more invasive questions. Let me quickly show you how the wrong approach looks, using a stockbroker gathering intelligence from a wealthy prospect as an example. After a brief introduction, during which the broker took control of the sale by establishing himself as an expert. He transitioned to the intelligence gathering phase by asking for permission to ask questions using the reasonable man tonality, to which the prospect replied, "Sure, go ahead," which is how you can expect virtually every prospect to respond. Provided that you've established yourself as an expert and asked for permission to ask questions using the correct tonality. And now comes the broker's first question, which is, "So tell me, John, how much money are you liquid for right now, including both your personal bank accounts and your different brokerage accounts around Wall Street? Oh, by the way, please include any mutual funds you have as well, as long as you can liquidate them within 7 days. "Excuse me," snaps the prospect in a tone of incredulity. "I don't even know you. Why on earth would I answer that?" "Oh, I'm sorry," says the broker in an apologetic tone. "Let me start with something else. What was your annual income last year, including any capital gains?" No response. "Just a ballpark," the broker adds, trying to prod the prospect to answering. "You can round?" Click. "Hello," says the broker to an empty telephone line. "Are you still there, John? Hello? Hello?" And just like that, the sale is over before it even started. With a huff and a puff, the prospect smashed the phone down in the broker's ear and had every justification to do it. After all, the broker had simply not earned the right to ask him those type of invasive questions yet. Not only did he lack the required level of trust and rapport, but he also lacked the benefit of having an intangible aspect of human communication on his side. Namely, the mitigating effect of desensitization. By way of definition, psychologists describe desensitization as a diminished emotional response to an adverse stimuli after repeated exposure to it. In layman's terms, it simply means that we have a tendency to get used to things. For example, something that you would normally find wholly offensive, like being asked an invasive question by someone who you hardly know, will barely cause you to raise an eyebrow after just a few minutes of desensitization. And that's especially true when it comes to someone gathering intelligence from you, as a result of the lubricating effect that comes from suddenly finding yourself in rapport with the person asking the questions. Again, I can't overestimate how crucial this distinction is to ensuring a successful outcome to an intelligence gathering session. Ignore it at your own peril. Rule number 5, ask each question using the right tonality. In chapter 11, which details how to make a sales presentation, I'll provide you with a list of big picture questions that have been proven to work in any industry along with their accompanying tonalities. For now, what you need to understand is that each prospecting question will have its own best tonality, which maximizes the chance of your prospect giving you the most forthright answer, while also ensuring that you maintain rapport with them in the process. Conversely, if you apply the wrong tonality to your question, then your prospect will answer it in a perfunctory manner at best. And while you might not completely break rapport, you will certainly bring the level down a few notches. Here's a quick example. Let's say you're a life insurance salesman, and you're at the home of a prospect trying to close him on a whole life policy. Given that life insurance is a fear-based sale, it's especially crucial that your intelligence gathering effort not only uncovers his primary pain point, but also amplifies it, as this will be the key to closing the sale. To that end, here's an example of an invasive question you might ask to begin the process of ferreting out the source of his pain. "So John, all things considered, what's your biggest fear right now with not having a life insurance policy in place? What's really keeping you up at night?" Now imagine if you attached a callous, almost aggressive tone to those words, as if you were chastising him for being so foolish and irresponsible for not having adequate life insurance coverage in place. It would be like you were saying to him, "So what's your greatest fear, John? Tell me, come on, let's go, tell me." Now, of course, you didn't actually say those extra words, tell me, come on, let's go, tell me, but that's precisely what he heard as a result of tonality's ability to add extra words onto your communications. And what he also heard was his own inner monologue saying, "This guy's a total asshole. He doesn't care about me, he doesn't feel my pain, and he's not sympathetic to my plight." Alternatively, if you had used the "I care" tonality, along with "I feel your pain," then the extra words your prospect would have heard would have said, "Wow, this guy really cares about me. He really genuinely wants to know." So again, if you attach the wrong tonality to your question, it will cause you to break rapport with your prospect while also eating away at your credibility as an expert. Conversely, if you attach the right tonality to your question, it will cause an increase in the level of rapport while also reinforcing your position as an expert. Remember, this applies to every question you ask during the intelligence gathering phase. There are no free questions. Rule number 6. Use the correct body language as the prospect responds. This too relates back to what I covered in the previous chapter, when I went through the body language principle of active listening, as well as distinction number 4 of this chapter, where your ability to actively listen as your client answers your questions will serve as the linchpin strategy for building rapport as you move through the intelligence gathering process, with your goal being to hit a high note as you prepare to transition into the main body of your sales presentation. In consequence, you need to be absolutely vigilant about following all the active listening rules that I laid out for you in Chapter 8. Here is an abbreviated list of the active listening techniques that you'll most frequently use during the intelligence gathering phase. 1. Nodding your head while your prospect is speaking. This shows that you understand what they're saying and that you're on the same page as them. 2. Narrowing your eyes and compressing your lips while nodding your head slowly when your prospect is disclosing an issue that's very important to them. 3. Narrowing your eyes even more while compressing your lips more intensely if the above topic deals with one of the prospect's pain points. In addition, you'll continue to nod your head slowly while letting out the appropriate oohs and ahs to show that you actually feel your prospect's pain. 4. Leaning forward when you ask an emotionally charged question, and then continuing to lean forward while your prospect answers, while also using the active listening techniques I laid out in number 3. 5. Leaning back when you ask a question that's grounded in logic, and continue to lean back and nod your head in understanding and scratch your chin thoughtfully while your prospect answers. While the above list assumes that the sales encounter takes place in person, for many of you, that will not always be the case. So when the encounter takes place over the phone, your active listening will be distilled down to the various oohs and ahs and ahas and yups that you let out as your prospect responds to your questions. That will let the prospect know that you're still on the same page as them and that you get what they're saying. Rule number 7. Always follow a logical path. The human brain is extraordinarily adept at analyzing a series of questions and determining whether or not they're being asked in a logical order. If they're not, then it will serve as a major red flag that the person who's asking them is not an expert in their field. For example, imagine being on the receiving end of the following series of intelligence gathering questions asked in exactly this order. 1. What part of town do you live in? 2. Are you married or single? 3. What kind of work do you do? 4. How long have you been living there? 5. Do you have any children? 6. What do you like most about your neighborhood? 7. Are you self-employed or do you work for someone else? Frankly speaking, if you've been asked these questions in an actual sales setting, by the time you reached question number 4, your internal monologue would have been raging away a mile a minute, saying things like, "What the hell is wrong with this guy? He seemed like an expert at first, but he obviously has no idea what he's talking about. Let's get this nonsense over with as quickly as possible and find a real expert, not an imposter like this guy." By the way, if you think I'm exaggerating, I'm not. The good news is, though, is that the entire issue is easily avoided. All you need to do is take the time to engage in a little strategic preparation, which in this particular case means making a complete list of your prospecting questions and then keep arranging them in different orders until you hit on the one that stands out as the most logical. Trust me when I say that the right order will be plainly obvious to you. This will be easy pickings now that I've raised your level of awareness. In fact, let's do a quick practice run with this right now, using the list of 7 questions we just went over. If you recall, I purposely arranged them so they'd be out of logical sequence. What I want you to do now is take out a pen and paper, or you can use your smartphone or computer, and make a list of all 7 questions in their most logical sequence. Once you've done that, here's the correct order. 1. What part of town do you live in? 2. How long have you been living there? 3. What do you like most about your neighborhood? 4. Are you married or single? 5. Do you have any children? 6. What kind of work do you do? And 7. Are you self-employed or do you work for someone else? Notice how these questions make perfect sense in this order. In fact, not only does each question pave the way for the ones that come after it, but also each of your prospects' responses will begin to paint the picture of a certain aspect of their life that you can fill in with more and more detail by asking follow-up questions based on their responses. Just make sure that when you ask your follow-up questions, you exhaust each line of questioning before you move on to the next one. In other words, don't ping-pong back and forth between your prepared questions and your follow-up questions, as it will break the logical flow. Remember, at this point in the sale, it's extremely rare that any one mistake will be damaging enough to cause a one-punch knockout. Rather, it will be like death from 1,000 cuts. In other words, each one of your mistakes or incongruencies, whether it's asking a question out of the logical sequence, attaching the wrong tonality to it, getting overly invasive before you've earned the right to, or forgetting to actively listen to your prospect's responses, will slowly but surely eat away at the rapport you've worked so hard to create, while also undermining your position as an expert, until you reach the point where one more mistake is enough to act as the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. Rule number 8. Make mental notes. Don't resolve their pain. When you're qualifying a prospect, all you should be doing is asking questions and making mental notes based on their responses. You do not want to try to resolve their pain at this point. In fact, if anything, you want to amplify that pain. Remember, pain serves as a warning signal that there's something wrong in their life, something that they need to take action to fix. So if you take them out of pain before you make your presentation, then you're actually doing them a huge disservice. In other words, when a prospect reveals their pain to you, you don't want to jump the gun and say, "Oh, great, there's no need to worry now. My product is going to take away all your pain, so there's no longer any reason to feel bad anymore. Just sit back and relax while I explain everything to you." If you do that, then you're shooting yourself in the foot in a massive way. You see, by applying a temporary balm to their pain, you're transforming your prospect from being a buyer in heat to being a buyer in power, which is the exact opposite of what you want to be doing. Instead, you want to amplify their pain by asking them a series of follow-up questions that actually future pace it, forcing them to experience the reality of being in even greater pain at some point down the road if they don't take action now to resolve it. This will ensure that your prospect not only understands the ramifications of not taking action to resolve their pain, but also feels those ramifications in their gut. Rule number 9. Always end with a powerful transition. The purpose of a transition is to move those prospects who are going to continue their journey down the straight line to the next step in the sales process, which is when you make your straight line sales presentation. In addition, this is also where you're going to eliminate the looky-loos and the mistakes, as well as any buyers in heat and buyers in power who aren't quite right for your product. You see, the simple fact is that not every buyer in power and buyer in heat should be taken farther down the straight line. For example, if your product is not a good fit for them, then you have a moral obligation to tell them that, to explain that you can't help them and that they really shouldn't be buying. You should say something along the lines of, Well, John, based on everything you just told me, this program isn't a particularly good fit for you. I'm really sorry about that, but I don't want to sell you something that you're not going to be thrilled with. And if you happen to know of another company that can help them, then you should direct them there. Of course, you're not morally obligated to do this, but it's definitely the right thing to do. Remember, today's unqualified prospect can be tomorrow's perfectly qualified prospect. And the amount of goodwill you establish by sending them somewhere else is incalculable. In fact, I've had situations where I did just that, and before I could even leave the table, the prospect started calling their friends to try to drum up business for me. And I've also had situations where a year later, I got a call out of the blue from someone I did that for. And now that person was ready to buy. Now let's talk about the other side of the equation, where after gathering all the necessary intelligence, you're 100% certain that your product can resolve your prospect's pain and improve the quality of their life. In that case, you would use a simple transition like this. Well, John, based on everything you just said to me, this program is definitely a perfect fit for you. Let me tell you why. Or you could substitute the word product for program, or use the actual name of either one. In that case, it would sound like this. Well, John, based on everything you just said to me, the 64-inch Samsung is definitely the perfect fit for you. Let me tell you why. And from there, you'll go directly into the main body of your sales presentation. Rule number 10, stay on the straight line. Don't go spiraling off to Pluto. In 2009, I was hired by a London-based seminar provider to do a private sales training for the company's 20 young salesmen who were struggling so badly that they could barely close a door. When I was maybe halfway through the first day of training, I passed by one of the salesmen's desks and heard him going off on some crazy tangent about duck hunting in the marshes of southern England. As it turned out, the subject of duck hunting had been raised by his prospect in response to a standard intelligence gathering question the salesman had asked him a few minutes earlier. A standard question that had absolutely nothing to do with shooting a bunch of innocent ducks. The question he'd asked was, "What kind of work are you currently doing?" And to be clear, the prospect didn't start his response by talking about duck hunting. Rather, he answered the question that he was asked, telling the salesman that he was a mid-level manager at a clothing manufacturer in Kent, but then rather than leaving it at that, the prospect decided to spiral off to Pluto by segueing into a long, drawn-out story about how the duck hunting in the Kent marshes was the best in all of England. In truth, these sorts of compound answers, where the prospect starts by answering your question and then finishes by spiraling off to Pluto, are very common during the intelligence gathering phase, and they're in no way problematic. What is problematic, however, is the disingenuous way in which the salesman handled it. "Oh my God," he exclaimed, as if it were completely bowled over. "What a coincidence this is. I love duck hunting too. What are the odds? I mean, you and me to both love duck hunting. I can't even begin to tell you how much." And on the salesman went, going back and forth with his prospect for 15 minutes, spewing out a bunch of nonsense about the exhilaration one gets from taking pot shots at a bunch of innocent ducks who can't shoot back. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not against duck hunting any more than I'm for it. Although I would like to think that if you're going to take the life of an unsuspecting duck, you'd at least have the common courtesy to then baste the little guy in orange sauce and make him into a gourmet meal. Either way, what's far more important is that you understand just how misguided the salesman's strategy was. Let me explain what I mean. A moment after the salesman slammed his phone down in defeat, he turned to me and muttered, "Damn it, I was so close. I can't believe I let that one slip away." "No, you aren't close," I replied flatly. "You never had a shot. You were too busy talking about duck hunting. I assume you made all that shit up, right? I mean, you don't exactly strike me as the duck hunting type. Where are you from, India?" "Sri Lanka," he replied meekly, looking down at the floor to avoid making eye contact. "Sri Lanka. Not exactly the world's duck hunting capital. Now, is it?" I said with a chuckle. "Anyway, why did you lie to the guy like that? What did you think you were going to accomplish?" I was trying to build rapport, he said defensively, like you said this morning. Wow, lesson learned, I said to myself. That's the last time I stress how important something is without also explaining how to actually do it. Fair enough, I said to the salesman. This one's on me. But for the record, what you just did is the exact opposite of what I meant. 10 minutes later, I had the entire sales force back in the training room, and I was standing before my trusty whiteboard, filling in the blanks for my morning training session. Let me tell you a little something about rapport, I said confidently. It is by far the single most misunderstood word in the English language. In fact, what most people think constitutes rapport is actually repulsive, meaning it repels people instead of attracting them, which is the exact opposite of what you're trying to accomplish with rapport in the first place. Now, after listening to a bunch of your sales pitches this morning, it's obvious that you guys think that if you pretend to like whatever your prospect likes, you'll end up getting into rapport with him. I paused for a moment to let my words hang in the air. Then I plowed on. Bullshit, I sputtered. There's no rapport there. People are far more skeptical than they used to be, and they're constantly on the lookout for that sort of bullshit. And make no mistake, if your prospect has even the slightest inkling that you're trying to pull something like that, then any chance you had of closing the sale completely evaporates. Make sense to everyone? All 20 salesmen nodded their heads in unison. Excellent. Now, in addition to that, what you're also doing is sending a subliminal message to your prospect that you're not really an expert. You see, experts are far too busy to waste time talking about things that aren't germane to their prospect's outcome. Their services are in demand, and an expert's time is his most valuable commodity. Also, experts are qualifying a prospect. They ask their questions in a very specific way, one that's both logical and intuitive, and they don't go off on tangents. That's what a novice does. They tend to be all over the place, and they're constantly going off to Pluto. Now again, genuine rapport is based on two things. First, that you care, meaning that you're not just looking to make a commission. You want to help your prospect fill his needs and resolve his pain. Basically, you have his best interest at heart, as opposed to your own. And second, that you're just like him, meaning human beings want to associate with people who are just like them versus the exact opposite of them. Let me give you a quick example. You wouldn't go check out a country club to see if you wanted to join and then come home to your wife and say, "Guess what, honey? I went to this really cool country club today. There wasn't a single soul there who was anything like me. They all had different politics, different religions, different interests. All in all, I didn't have a single thing in common with any of them. So I joined." Now, if you did that, your wife would look at you like you were out of your mind. However, your decision would have made perfect sense to her if you'd said, "I went to this really cool club today. People were just like us. They all shared our politics, our religious beliefs, our family values, and almost all of them played tennis, so I joined." The bottom line is this. We don't associate with other people based on our differences. We associate based on our commonalities. However, that being said, this is precisely where you guys are all making the classic mistake. You see, the way you think that you're supposed to accomplish this is by playing the pretend game. Like if he loves fishing, then you love fishing. And if he loves duck hunting, then you love duck hunting. And if he loves going on safaris, then you love going on safaris, and on and on. Now, I'll get into the ethical ramifications of this later, insofar as how totally unacceptable it is for you guys to be lying through your teeth like that. But for now, let me repeat what I just said to you guys about the efficacy of doing this. Specifically, that it's a complete bunch of bullshit. There's no rapport there. That's actually repulsive to people. In fact, I'll give you a real-world example using something I heard one of you guys rambling about this morning. And with that, I spent the next few minutes giving the group a comical account of the duck hunting fiasco I'd been subjected to that morning in order to keep the mood light. When I got to the point in the story where the prospect had just spiraled off to Pluto, I began mercilessly poking fun at the salesman for his decision to join the prospect there, spending over 15 minutes orbiting the barren rock as the two of them went back and forth about the frickin' wonders of duck hunting. Then, changing to a more serious tone, I added, "But still, in his defense, it wasn't like he could just cut his prospect off in mid-sentence when he started spewing out all that duck hunting nonsense. And by the way, guys, I'm just using this call as an example. The same thing applies to all of you. When your prospect starts to spiral off to Pluto, you're not going to say, whoa, 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 now listen, pal, I'm an expert in my field, and as an expert, I don't have time to listen to your worthless drivel about the price of tea in China. So I want you to stop rambling about this nonsense and answer my questions directly so we stay on the straight line.